Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com. Ellen's featured guest interview today is with Tom Greco, a global expert and author on monetary systems, who will shed a broader light on why things like the 2008 bank collapse occurs at all on a regular basis. Thomas Greco will delve into the private debt-based banking regime that has been exposed by insiders for decades. Here's a short excerpt from their conversation.
The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. And basically, this is the way it has been.
With that as documented historical context, you can see why the folks in California are excited about moving toward public control of public dollars.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Thomas Greco, a writer and lecturer who is regarded as one of the leading experts in monetary theory and history, in credit clearing systems, and in complementary currencies. Tom has written many articles and four books, the most recent of which is The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. He is also a former professor of business and has traveled all over the world, lecturing, teaching, and advising. Tom, it's great to be talking to you.
Thank you, Ellen. It's great to be with you.
So, you've written extensively on the dysfunctional nature of our conventional money and banking system and how a more ideal money system could be structured. You're very good at outlining the problem, so I thought I'd start with that. Where has our money system gone wrong, and why is there never enough money to go around?
The fundamental flaw in the monetary system as it exists today is the fact that money is created when banks make loans, and they charge interest on those loans. And with the passage of time, the size of the debt increases automatically because of the compound interest that's built into it. So you have a continual explosion of debt, an exponential explosion of debt, which is necessary for the system to continue. If the debt were not continually increased, there would necessarily be numerous defaults on existing debts, or the money supply would shrink, and the economy would collapse. This is sort of what happened during the Great Depression of the 1930s. There was a dearth of official money in circulation. When the private sector gets all loaned up, so to speak, that is, when it cannot take on any additional debt, then the government steps in to become the borrower of last resort. And we've seen this happen over and over again. Now, in business school, they taught us that the business cycle was sort of something that was just an automatic part of the system. It was just there. It's like a natural phenomenon. But it's not a natural phenomenon. It's an artifact of the interest-based debt money system. So the other parts of the system that are dysfunctional and causing tremendous difficulties is the fact that banking is centralized. There is a banking cartel that is supported by the government that enables a few to prosper at the expense of the many. So we've seen, especially in the last 40 years, a continual increase in the concentration of wealth and power in the hands of few. And it's very well documented that the differences between the various income and wealth classes are becoming ever greater. So when the Occupy movement talks about the 1%, actually they should be talking about the 0.1%, because this is the upper echelon of the economic and power pyramid. And those who control money control everything else, including the politics. So these are some of the things that we need to get around. My proposal has always been that we need to devolve power toward communities and toward the people in general. And the way to do that is to reinvent money and banking.
Yeah, well, I want to get into that, but going back to what's wrong with the system, I totally agree about the whole interest problem, and I've been beating that horse for years. But, you know, I always get pushback from people who say, well, you can pay it because of the velocity of money. In other words, say, for example, you're the lender. You make a $1,000 loan to the borrower at 20%, payable at $100 a month for a year. So in a year, the whole loan plus interest is paid off. So every month you hire the borrower to scrub your floors, and you pay him $100 for that. So every month you're paying him basically what he, I mean, the argument is that because the loans are paid back over time, you can recirculate that money and get it to, I mean, I'd love to have a good response to that. My response is that, okay, fine, but first of all, the banker doesn't hire the borrowers. I mean, it's true. In a public banking system, that is pretty much what would happen. You would recirculate the money into the local economy. And so maybe arguably there, you know, you could overcome the interest problem. But in the real world, the bankers don't hire their borrowers. The borrowers are probably out of work, or they're certainly not getting paid enough to pay off their loans and still have money left over for all the things they want to do, et cetera. And we've got other drains on the system, like the fact that even if there were no interest, people don't spend all their money back into the system. And because it's all an advance in the first place, you know, borrowed money that has to be paid back. If it's not all paid back, if some of it goes under mattresses, then there's not enough money in the system. So what do you say to all that?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. It's the bankers don't spend all the money that comes to them in the form of interest. The interest, basically, whether it's in the bank, in the hands of the bankers, or in the secondary market where capitalists lend out their surplus, that money does not get spent. It gets invested. So you have a continual search for investment opportunities. And a lot of that comes from privatizing the commons. You have rent seekers everywhere trying to take control of the commons and charge those who use the commons for access. But your arguments are correct. I think this idea about the velocity of money and the ability for the debt to be repaid is nonsense, and I haven't ever seen the logic of that. So I think the burden is upon those who make that argument to show how it actually works. But as you point out, the bankers don't hire the people that scrub the floors. That's in the secondary market. So
yeah.
I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on this.
Well, we know for a fact that debt always grows faster than the money available to repay it. So how do you explain that?
The empirical evidence is plain. You know, debt keeps increasing in both the public and the private sector, and it's increasing without end. That's the only way to keep the system going, and that's why I say the government must step in as the borrower of last resort. If the private sector can't borrow, then the government must borrow to keep the money supply pumped up. And the question is, what are the limits to that? When do we reach the limit?
Which we seem to be. It certainly looks like we're pushing the limits right now. And you prefer decentralization, I know, and you're a big advocate of community currencies or mutual credit clearing systems. Do you want to explain what a mutual credit clearing system is and how it works? I mean, I think most people are familiar with community currencies, but like as a piece of paper that some community prints. But nowadays we have trade clearing systems that don't use paper at all. They're just digital, right? So do you want to explain that?
Yeah, well, what we're talking about is credit. You have, I make the distinction, and this isn't original, between exchange credit, what used to be called turnover credit, and investment credit. Turnover credit, or exchange credit, is short term. It's the credit that's given to producers in order to enable them to produce. That is credit that they use to pay their suppliers and their employees for all of the inputs that go into the production. And then this money that's created on the basis of production that's going to market becomes the means of exchange for people to take those goods and services off the market. So you can say that money, if it's properly created on the basis of goods and services coming to market, is a representation of the value of those goods and services, and that enables those goods and services to be purchased. So on the other side, you've got investment credit. Investment credit is basically savings. Savings and investment are two sides of the same coin. It's surplus that people have that they want to put aside to be able to access later on when their earning capacity is diminished or non-existent. For example, when people retire from gainful employment or when they're disabled. So this is a whole subject that needs a thorough discussion. The distinction between the exchange function and the savings slash investment function. And I did some of that in my first book, which was called Money and Debt, A Solution to the Global Crisis. But, you know, you have to look at how do we save in a modern economy? We save by obtaining a claim against someone who is going to provide us with what we need in the future. And there are various kinds of claims. There's debt claims and equity claims, like shares in a corporate stock. So we have to make that distinction between short-term exchange credit and long-term investment credit, which is the way we save. When we talk about mutual credit clearing, what we're talking about is taking the power to allocate credit away from banks and using it directly ourselves. The way I put it is, in today's system, we give our credit to the banks and allow them to lend it back to us and charge us interest for the privilege. Now, when banks do business amongst themselves, let's say I pay you with a check drawn on my credit union here in Tucson. You take that check and you deposit it in your credit union or bank, wherever you happen to live. And now my bank owes your bank because they have given you cash or a deposit based on my check. And the banks have a clearinghouse. In the old days, every local community had a clearinghouse where the banks would take the checks at the end of each day, and they would sort them out and determine which bank owed which other banks how much. And there might be millions of dollars worth of checks, but they would net these out amongst themselves and then settle the accounts with a payment, which would be much smaller amount than the total transactions that they were clearing. Well, if banks can clear credits amongst themselves, producers can clear credits amongst themselves directly without having the need for using bank money or borrowing from a bank. We can finance producer credit through direct credit clearing associations. So we have multiple associations like this currently in operation. They're called commercial trade exchanges, incorrectly called barter exchanges. And basically, they have a membership consisting of businesses who buy and sell amongst themselves, and they simply keep a ledger of accounts. They don't use money to make these payments. They simply pay each other with their own internal credits. So let's say that you're a restaurateur and you're a member of a trade exchange. You join the trade exchange and you're given a line of credit based on your capacity to provide meals to the community. So now you can go ahead and spend. Let's say I'm an accountant. You hire me to keep your books. So now you pay me with the credits that you draw from your line of credit. So now your line of credit gets reduced. Your account gets debited for the amount that you pay me, and my account gets credited for the price that I charge you for my services.
Is there no interest on the line of credit?
No, typically there is no interest on these lines of credit. Trade credit should be interest-free. And this is simply an extension of current business practice. When businesses trade with one another, it's typically on open account. I will buy something, let's say, from a manufacturer. Let's say I'm a computer shop. I buy a bunch of computers from the manufacturer, and they send me an invoice, and they give me 30 days or 60 days or some other time period to pay. So basically, they're giving me an interest-free line of credit. What we're doing with a mutual credit clearing exchange is we're doing this on a multilateral basis instead of a bilateral basis. So the manager of the exchange makes an assessment as to the credit limits that each member business can maintain and allocates credit on that basis. So the credit clearing algorithm is an important part of a mutual credit system, where each business is evaluated according to its capacity to provide value to the community. And on that basis, we've created basically an internal money supply.
Are there fees for that, for managing all that?
Yes, of course. This is a business that must have adequate revenues to pay for its expenses of providing the services. Now, commercial trade exchanges typically provide services on the basis of payments either in cash or in trade credit. And one of my chapters in The End of Money and the Future of Civilization goes into detail about how these mutual credit clearing exchanges work and what are the limitations of the current practice in the trade exchange industry. So when I outline those limitations, I also provide some recommendations. Basically, the trade exchange industry is limited by the scale and scope of its operations.
It should be a major limitation on all community currencies. There are just not enough products available to make in our locally.
The answer is to network these small local trade exchanges together, and this is being done already to some extent with something called universal currency. It's a inter-exchange currency that's been instituted by the International Reciprocal Trade Association, and the volume of trades between exchanges has been growing. It's sort of the way the local trade exchanges clear obligations amongst themselves when their members want to trade across exchange lines. So this is growing, and it needs to be improved upon. I can foresee in the future, this is my grand vision, for small, relatively local mutual credit clearing exchanges in the millions scattered around the world and all networked together into an internet of exchange where my trade credits and my local trade exchange can be allocated to me locally based on my ability to provide goods and services and my reputation for good service and all of that. But I can use my credits globally to get what I need when I'm outside my local region. Just like when I travel to England or Malaysia or Thailand, I can use my credits and my local credit union to get the British pounds or the euros or the ringgits that I need in the place that I happen to be. So we can replicate many of the advantages of the existing system without having the disadvantages of that system.
My vision is to nationalize Amazon, and we could all like sell into it for credits, and or eBay, nationalize eBay. We could all sell into it and use our credits to buy other things.
I can go along with that. I think that Amazon and Facebook and all of these other huge platform businesses are public utilities, and they ought to be publicly owned and accountable.
I agree. They would have a fit, you know. I mean, it'd be a big lawsuit, I'm sure. But one thing that could happen would be for the central bank to just buy their stock, and it's a done deal. Switzerland buys stock, and the Bank of Japan buys, the Swiss central bank buys stock, and the Bank of Japan buys exchange traded funds.
Yeah, well, this is one part of the quantitative easing that has become the vogue since the 2008 banking crisis, and this is the way that they basically saved the system from collapse by the central bank.
Well, it seems to me that quantitative easing and all the other outrageous things they've done has just shown us what can be done. I mean, there was all this outrage like it would cause hyperinflation. That didn't happen. Of course, we know why it didn't even go into the real.
Well, we had to explore that. Why didn't it cause inflation?
Because it didn't inflate the consumer market, because it didn't go into the consumer market. Yeah.
Exactly. It went into the hands of the already rich, and it went into inflation of asset prices rather than inflation of consumer goods. But, you know, despite what the government says, we've had considerable amounts of inflation in consumer good prices as well.
Well, it depends. I mean, certainly in housing, but I think they exclude that from consumer goods, which it's
well,
not.
They play games with consumer price index, so it doesn't show up in the consumer price index. But there are shadow stats that show the real consumer price index, and you can find those online.
Yeah. Well, anyway, and they bought stock, and there are different things that we now know a central bank could do. It seems to me because there is this gap between the available money supply and the debt, you always need more money out there, which Michael Hudson has written, you know, extensively about how in ancient Mesopotamia they maintained a system with 33% interest for 2,000 years without booms and busts, and the way they did it was with the periodic debt jubilees. But so what we could do is periodic pumping of extra money into the system, but into the actual economy, not, you know, the real economy, the productive economy and the consumer economy. You could do a universal basic income. You could buy up things like Amazon. I know there's a proposal out there to buy up the oil companies, because otherwise we'll never get them to do what we want. All those things might be controversial, but the thing is, we now know that the tools are there. They've demonstrated what they can do. So,
the key point that you made there, and that Michael Hudson talks about in his book, is the debt forgiveness, the jubilee. And the jubilee is way overdue in the modern economy. Debt forgiveness is something that needs to be done when you have interest in the system, because you always end up with a situation where some of the debtors are not going to be able to pay. This is automatic in a system that employs interest.
You said that local public banks could be good, but you're opposed to central banks, at least in their current form. I'd say we need central banks too, so we can, you know, get this extra money into the system, but that they need to be nationalized so that they serve as public utilities. But anyway, you are a great historian of banking and money, so I just wondered if you could go into the shady history of our central banking system. I know you've quoted Carol Quigley and others, so if you could remind us of where it's come from and why we want to be alerted.
Yeah, sure. Carol Quigley was a professor at Georgetown University, and he taught many notable people in government, including Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton praised Quigley in his acceptance speech when he was nominated for president in 1992. And Quigley wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope. This was published in 1966. And Quigley was an insider. I mean, he had access to all of the information of the elite power brokers. And he said in his book, the powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. And basically, this is the way it has been. We have the Bank for International Settlements, we have the International Monetary Fund, we have the World Bank. These are all aspects of this global monetary regime. And the central banks do work in concert, as we have seen. When inflation gets too high in one country, they will shift it over to another country by their central bank doing what needs to be done, or by manipulating foreign exchange rates between the currencies. In my opinion, given this solid control by the banking and financial elite over not only economics and finance, but also over politics worldwide, you know, I say whoever controls money controls everything else, I don't see that there's much chance of reform. I don't see that a centralized system, no matter who has nominal ownership of it, is going to really solve the problem. My approach is to find ways to devolve power to the communities and to the people themselves. And if we believe in democracy, that's basically what democracy it is, where people have control. And representative democracy, I think, is an oxymoron. If it's representative, it's basically elite control. It's not democracy. So yeah. The only way that I can see forward in devolving power, political power, is to devolve economic power to communities and people. And the way we do that is to take control of credit. And we do this by establishing mutual credit clearing exchanges and private community currencies that do not depend on banks, that do not require government money or central bank-created money. The problem with most of the local currencies that we're familiar with that have been tried over the last 30 years is that most of them are sold for cash. You have to have government money to bring them into existence. So you've got Toronto dollars and Berkshires in the United States, and you've got Bristol pounds and Brixton pounds and Lewes pounds and any number of other local pounds in the UK. They all follow this model of selling the currency into existence for political money. And this really doesn't do much except act as a gift certificate or gift card. You know, when you go to Target and you buy a gift card, that's basically the same thing as a local currency that's sold for cash. But they do it even better because they don't allow the gift card to be redeemed back into cash. You have to use it to buy merchandise or services from the issuing business. But these local currencies that are sold for cash, they typically allow it to be redeemed back into cash. So it might change hands once or twice before it gets redeemed back into cash and doesn't accomplish very much.
One other topic that you expressed interest in, I had written an article about Mark Carney's saying that we've run out of ammunition. I mean, several big central bankers are now saying they're out of ammunition and they've got to do things differently. Mark Carney said we needed to change the game, and his proposal was basically he wants to get rid of the dollar as reserve currency globally and have a central bank issued reserve currency instead. And you responded, you thought instead of a game changer, what they really wanted was more power. So, I mean, that's what I was saying, too. But do you want to go into that a little bit, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I can agree with him that we certainly need to change what we're doing. We need to change the game. He and I agree on that, and you do, too. But what's the new game? That's the question.
Right.
And I think their new game is just more concentration of power and wealth and centralization of control. Instead of the dollar as the global reserve currency, they want to create another reserve currency under the control of a global central bank. And this reserve currency will simply be a further consolidation of power. I mean, the IMF has already proposed this kind of thing, and there's plenty of documentation out there as to the direction they want to go. It doesn't devolve power. it concentrates power further into the hands of corporate and banking elite. You know, we've seen governments being disempowered to a considerable extent over the period of time, from especially the 1980s. But that power is being migrated upward to corporate entities. And these corporate entities are no longer national entities, they're global entities. The laws are such that a company can incorporate in the United States or some other country and do business anywhere in the world, and their charter is respected. There should be limitations on corporate charters. You know, once we grant limited liability to an artificial person that we call a corporation, that entity ought to pay back to the general community the value of that privilege. And this is something that Andrew Jackson said way back in 1832 when he vetoed the recharter bill for the Second Bank of the United States. That was one of the things that he pointed out, that when government grants a privilege or an exclusive monopoly, the people ought to be compensated for that. There is a social cost to the corporate charter. And what the banking elite want to do is they simply want to accelerate and maximize the shift of power from national governments to the global corporate elite. And that's what their plan for a global central bank and a new global reserve currency will do. What I want to do is to decentralize the control of credit to empower people, to migrate power away from central governments downward to communities and the people at large.
I totally agree. We don't want an international currency that's issued by a cartel of central banks, which would remove it one step even further. I mean, right now, theoretically, at least we have some control over our central banks in that Congress could repeal the Federal Reserve Act or amend it, which they do routinely. But we would have no control over this central bank organization.
Nominally, the government has control of the central bank, but in actuality, the other way around, the central bankers control the government. Not the central bankers per se, but the bankers that control the central bankers.
Well, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Ellen. I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to address your listeners. They can find more information about my work, my books, my articles, my interviews and presentations on my website. It's beyondmoney.net, beyondmoney.net. And we also have a podcast that's available through that site. Thanks again for having me on.
Okay, thanks for talking to you. It's always great to hear your views.
And likewise yours.
Thanks. I've been speaking with Thomas Greco, a writer and lecturer in monetary theory and history and complementary currencies, and has written several books, including The End of Money and the Future of Civilization.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.
Money!